Welcome to Writer's Blockbusters, the show where we treat the final edit of the movie like the script. I'm one of the hosts, Bob Rose. I'm at Thundergrunt Bob on whatever the fuck it's called now. On Twitter. We're calling it Twitter. Twitter. And next, Jimmy's going to introduce himself.
I am Jimmy George. I am a screenwriter and script consultant. My ex-Twitter handle is at Jimmy R. George.
So you don't have it anymore? Is that what you're saying? It's your ex-Twitter handle?
My ex-Twitter handle.
Or is it your old girlfriend's Twitter
right,
handle?
Your ex. Sure.
And I am on Threads occasionally now. I'm doing that. I don't care. I'll
so
say
am
it. And that's at _ Jimmy George. So, yeah.
Jamie?
I'm Jamie Nash. I am a screenwriter as well, though on strike, so I can't really – I'm not doing too much these days.
You're a pickleball player.
Very sad. Professional pickleball player that doesn't get paid. I wrote two books, Save the Cat Writes for TV, Save the Cat Beat Sheet Workbook. You can buy them on Amazon as we speak. And my Twitter handle is at Jamie_Nash. And that's all. I'm not on Threads yet. I'm actually thinking I'm like next week, I might start doing like little TikTok kind of dances. No, I'm just kidding.
I was like, I have to. Dude, you need to juggle. These people need to see your juggling abilities. Jamie juggles while we're doing the podcast.
Jamie's posted some videos of those.
He's spitting knowledge. He's spitting golden knowledge while juggling.
There you go. I'll be the juggling. But I'm thinking about doing like, you know, you see other screenwriters do it too. But the little, you know, 1 minute clip kind of screenwriting tips or something like
that.
I've been thinking about doing it for a while. I'm on strike. What else do I have to do? So that might show up one of these days, but it's not there yet. So
you can also put those
Instagram.
If it's short enough, you can also put those on Twitter.
I figure I'll send them across all media.
I'm excited.
All media.
Yeah.
So I made a list of topics that I want to cover. And so we'll see. You know, I have my five or six initial topics I'd like to cover, but I have to figure out all the technical side because I won't mind to have screen grabs and stuff like that.
So
I gotta figure all that fun stuff. Anyway,
you'll get there.
We'll look forward to that, listeners. You got the Jamie's
there you go. One day in the future.
Unless the strike stops and you're like, oh, fuck TikTok.
That's what'll happen.
Yeah, just like, screw it.
I'll have five videos that are like really old, and that'll be all that's on my TikTok forever.
That's fine. My TikTok has one video, so I can't really throw stones. Today, I guess in celebration of Oppenheimer coming out a couple days ago, we decided to talk about Nolan, and we thought that the most interesting Nolan movie to talk about was Memento, right? That was the consensus, I believe.
Yes.
Like, we considered other ones, so don't yell at
us.
We
did. We debated.
Yeah. But Memento seemed like the obvious choice for most interesting. Before we get into our topics, let's go around and talk about, I guess, our relationship with this movie. It's from the year 2000, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're talking a 23-year-old movie now. It feels like doesn't feel like it's that old, but it's 23 years old. Who wants to go first?
I'll start because I got like somewhat of an anecdote for it.
Cool.
So, it. 2000 to take you there, to take you back to the year 2000. Yes, Bob. I was gonna do it, but. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
All right. In the year 2000, I was 1 year into like screenwriting and trying to educate myself and learn about the craft. And it's hard for people to remember, and it's really hard for me to remember that like there didn't used to be such a thing as like movie buzz. Like it wasn't a thing. So like indie darlings, like your average moviegoer did not see indie darlings. Like discovering an indie darling that someone told someone to watch that ended up getting you to watch it was like a buried treasure, wonderful thing, right? There wasn't like all these movie news like machine was at its infancy. And so I did not hear about this movie like whatsoever. I was not like itching to see Memento, like, oh, I've heard about this awesome, you know. And there used to be Best Buy. This is Time Machine on Tuesdays.
Oh my God, I remember.
The new release DVDs came out every Tuesday. And I, no matter what, would go on Tuesdays, like 10 a.m., check out the new releases that were on sale. And I'm not a blind buy guy. Like, that's not what I do. Like, I'm not going to spend money on a movie unless I've seen it. But I'd usually show up at Best Buy, find a few good titles that are new releases, and spend $20. And that's my Tuesday morning routine. And I walked into Best Buy the Tuesday morning that Memento came out, having never heard of it. And there's a fucking huge line. And I'm like, what's the deal? It's like some random Tuesday. And in the line, every single person in line is holding the DVD for Memento. Every single one. There's like 30 people in line holding this movie I've never heard of and never seen. So I was like, you know what? Fuck it. I got to buy this movie. Like, I have to see what this is all about, right? And then I took it home and I loved it. And I was like, what the fuck is this movie? And Jamie, blast from the past, I went online to Drew's Scriptorama, which was like in the late 90s, one of the only couple websites that existed where you could download the screenplay because, you know, I was sort of in that zone having just started screenwriting and I wanted to learn. I was soaking all the knowledge I could. So I was like, let me get this script, see what it looks like on the page. And it was out there. It was on Drew's Scriptorama, but I didn't have I was so new to it, so I couldn't possibly like take it apart. Like, it's so complicated, and like, I'm honestly like intimidated 23 years later to try to deconstruct the movie that I was unable to deconstruct 20 year old me when I'm first starting. So 23 years later, we're gonna see if I've gotten any better at this. So that's my Memento anecdote.
Yeah, it was an explosive DVD release. I can concur with you. I remember that.
Everybody. Oh, and I just will one say, like, my actual opinion of the movie. I love the movie. I do feel like a lot of other Nolan's movies, in my opinion, it's very cold. And like Leonard's situation, like, it's, you know, you can relate to him on a very basic human level, but like, no one in the world is going to be dealing with the problems that Leonard is dealing with. So because of that, even though I think it's like a challenging and interesting rewatch, I just don't, it doesn't stay with me. It's sort of like, it's not a one and done. It's not a one trick pony, but because Leonard's situation and his character, he's, you know, he's shitty. He's a bad guy. He's shitty. He's killing people. He's punching women. I don't like love the movie because of those things, if that makes sense. I love its execution. There you go.
Cool. Jamie.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I don't really remember a lot of like when I saw it or, you know, but it was prime for me, like movie loving me who was into independent film at the time. So this one would have been a big one for me. And I'm sure I saw it in the theater. I don't really remember when I saw it, which is kind of strange for me. But the other thing I will say about it, much like Jimmy, I probably started writing in 98, 99, something like that. 90. It's weird for me because I think I slowly ramped up and then I went like really hard into it around 98, 99. So around 2000, I was in screenwriting mode. That's probably my first scripts I was starting to complete and stuff like that. So I was super impressed with this movie and a little jealous of this movie when it came out. Like, I wish I had written something like this or come up with the gimmick. I was kind of a gimmick guy. And I wish I had done that gimmick. I should have kind of thought of it first. Not that he thought of it first. There was precedent. You know what else is weird? I was looking, you know, I love my lists of years and stuff like that.
2000, yeah, please do it.
2000 to me is, this might be the deadest list for me personally. Not that any of these movies are bad. 99
was one of the best ever.
99.
One of the best
99,
ever.
No, that's exactly it. 99, we come off like one of the best ever, where we have Sixth Sense and we have Matrix, Toy Story 2, Matrix,
Big Lebowski,
Phantom Menace. No, we have the Monk, the Mummy, Blair Witch. We got all those movies came out.
American Beauty.
But the list that comes out in 2000, like none of these are movies that they're all fine movies. They're just not, you know, ones that
you're
really
talking about.
Me up.
So top, how the box office list, right?
The box office, yeah. So how the Grinch Stole Christmas, Mission Impossible 2, Gladiator. I'm not a huge Gladiator fan, but I'm fine. It's fine for me, but it's not like an epic. The Perfect Storm. Yeah. Meet the Parents, X-Men, Scary Movie, What Lies Beneath,
X-Men.
Dinosaur, Aaron Brockovich, Charlie's Angels, Nutty Professor 2. I mean, this is the top movies. So Gladiator is the only one that really pops, is one that probably really stands the test of time.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Mission Impossible 2 still doing it.
That franchise lived.
I don't know. Depending on where you stand, some people think that's the worst one, and so it's usually considered the worst one.
For sure.
Yeah,
it's a weird one. John Woo one. Yeah.
And while I like it because I'm a John Woo fan, I understand why people don't like it. Yeah,
I like all of them.
It's funny, of the top 10 of those, the movie that pops to me the most is like Scary Movie. I don't know why, because it was such a weird, I always love spoof movies, but it felt like when that movie came out, for that to be the juggernaut it was with the Wayans brothers.
Yeah, crazy.
I was like, so it kind of popped.
I remember seeing that opening night in theaters. It was nuts. It was, yeah.
Packed.
Me too.
Packed.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Packed. And everybody was, I remember that was around the time when they were being really strict on not letting certain people in, under a certain age.
Underage,
and,
yep.
They would buy another ticket and go in that and stuff, and there was all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, so Memento for me is a big screenwriting movie, like one I was, again, jealous of, one I wanted to emulate, one that I wanted to find a similar gimmick. But I think, much to Jimmy's point, I think it's like a magic trick, in that once you see the magic trick, I didn't really need to revisit the magic trick. You know, he performed his magic trick. And that's it. It's a good magic trick, and I appreciate it. Yeah. And I think it's super clever, and I'm jealous that he got there first. But at the same time, it's not a movie. This might only be my second or probably third watch. I probably watched it right like when it came on video after I saw it in the theater, just to kind of let me watch it with knowledge of the end, you know, this time.
Yeah.
And then this was the first time probably in, you know, 20 years I've seen it.
Are you done? I didn't know if you had more to say, Jamie. No, I didn't know if he had more to say. I didn't know if he was like thinking. I was gonna say. So I might have said this on the show before. For 5 years I managed a mom and pop video store, and that started around 2005. And this is one of those movies where like the cover of it haunts me, you know, because like we had like five copies of it, but it was one of those movies that just was constantly cycling in and out. Like it, even for 5 years old, it, back when I started, it was still a huge renter, and people would always talk to me about it. So this movie specifically reminds me of that time. I wasn't into screenwriting then at all. I was just into movies. That's why I was working at a video store, being a stereotype that I was, but like, yeah, this was that. It's just like that cover haunts my brain. Like I, even when I looked at it on the streamer service, I was just like, oh, that cover. I almost hate it. You know what I mean? Like I've seen it so many times. I just hate it. As for the movie itself, I'll say this. When we decided to do it, I groaned internally. I think it's a really good thing for the show, and I'm excited to talk about it with you guys. But the thought of having to watch it a few times literally made me like go, oh God, like it was a chore. It's an absolute chore for me to do that for the show. And that's rare for me. This is almost like my version of Jamie watching Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, where I was just like, because here's the thing. I think it's a really well-made movie, like most of Nolan's things. I think everything you guys have said so far holds true. But here's my thing. I love movies for character. You know, I really cling on to characters. And this movie to me, it's like, it's just there's nothing there because his actual condition makes me kind of not give a shit. it's like the actual premise makes me not give a shit about what happens.
That's so I'm interesting.
Like, so this guy's never going to remember anything. Fuck, I don't care whatever. I don't even give a shit. You know, like there's part of that. I think it's well constructed. Incredible cast, incredible acting.
Yeah.
It's got some of my favorite people in it. So it's not like I'm throwing stones at it or saying it's bad in any way. It's just really not for me. Also, Jamie kind of hit on my point is I'm not big on rewatching and revisiting mysteries. Mysteries are not among my favorites of any sort.
Gotcha. Okay.
Because like once you know the magic trick, I'm like, the journey is not as interesting to me anymore of finding out what it is. So there's just nothing in a different way than you said, Jimmy. There's nothing for me to really grab onto here that made me ever want to rewatch this. And I got to say, it was a chore to rewatch this.
I'm sorry, Bob.
No, it's fine. I'm not complaining about the show. I'm just saying like it's very rare. We're doing a classic episode that is a movie that I kind of am not into. You know, and I think that's rare for us because I think I'm usually really into the classic episodes.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, so this is a rare thing. And, you know, I got to say the last thing, if I were to criticize the movie in a way to me, it seems like in worse hands, this movie would very much be a movie that Donald Kaufman from Adaptation would have written. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, the slightest push one way or the other could make it these absolute film school hacky premise that almost that borderlines on pretentious and annoying. But just because Nolan is skilled enough, it never reaches there, but it could.
Yeah.
It's like on the verge of it at all times.
It is.
It's just on the verge of it at all times.
I know there's one scene where they were arguing and I was like, this feels almost like something I watched at a bad film festival screening.
Remember an Adaptation when he's like, he's the detective, he's actually the serial killer too. It feels something like that, you know?
Yeah. But it and doesn't also, feel that way. I see what you're saying. Yeah. I felt that emotional response while watching it.
Right.
You know what it is? There's a little bit of that write what you know thing that I think as you get older, you probably do more and more organically.
Yeah.
This feels like a movie where he didn't write what he knew. It was like a cool idea. Like, we watched these movies. Listen to this cool idea. It can be kind of film noir. Like you say, nobody has. I mean, maybe somebody has a similar version of this disease, kind of, but not the way he has it. You know, it's not.
I mean, Jamie, there's two characters
everything seems
in this
so
movie.
Fake.
Yeah. And there's, even like when I was looking for, I was like, oh, I didn't remember that. There's this thing the movie does that really throws me, which is for much of its runtime, it seems like there's an intentional repetition that slamming of doors is a trigger for him to go back to square one mentally. Like every time a door is slammed in a situation, all of a sudden he doesn't remember. And like even Natalie's character slams doors on purpose outside to like trigger that, like as if she knows it. But then in the finale, he's slamming doors left and right and it doesn't trigger him to go back to zero. So I'm like, oh, so that was bullshit. Like, I'm so confused. I thought you were like making me pay attention to every time someone's going to slam a door, he's going to go back to like zero. Cause there are some scenes where it's not just many scenes where it's not that he just woke up. It's like, he's in the middle of like a conversation and like a door gets slammed and all of a sudden he's like, why am I here? What is happening? Like, anyway, just reminded me of that problem.
And like Jamie just said, that's a good idea, you know, like write what you know. But like when that's happening, Jimmy, where it's just him going, what happened every 5 minutes? I don't understand why I should care anymore.
Ah, well,
the tension part. But
I
mean, that just goes with what I was saying at my opening.
Yeah.
Like it just.
Yeah.
It's a chore for me to watch this movie. That's that's the difference of this episode to almost all of our episodes for classic movies is like we usually I don't think we've ever done one I haven't like loved. So this is like actually new.
It's hard to. Yeah.
This is actually new for me. Yeah. Like it's like new because I'm like, Oh God.
Like, I have to no, and to your point, this. Like that's like a taste thing, right? Some people want
I have they learned
want to be challenged in, to the extreme.
Yes. And I have learned by researching it for this episode that so many people worship this movie and they worship it deeply. They love the puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
Great on them. I mean, if that's what you're in for, if you're in for puzzles and stuff like that, and that's what you consider great and that's what enthralls you, this is your movie. Not so much for me.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
But yeah, let's get into it because we're obviously bordering on talking about some of these things.
Yeah.
With it. I mean, right now we've already kind of addressed some of this narrative gimmicks and reverse chronology sources. Right?
Yeah, Jamie, you put this on there, so I want to see what you have to say first, because I have some things to say about it.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to just briefly talk about, by the way, we did skip over who wrote it, and it's Christopher Nolan and his brother, Jonathan. Apparently, Jonathan pitched it
Bob
to
wasn't
him.
Wasn't even interested in talking about
it. It's the Nolans who gives a shit.
Yeah.
Sorry, everyone.
He's like, I'll fuck this.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, okay, that's the end of this show. apparently Jonathan and Christopher Nolan were driving from Chicago to LA, and Jonathan pitched him a story idea he had, and it was the movie without the gimmick, which I can only imagine. Like, to me, the movie without the gimmick, I mean, I probably would.
It's just watching people abuse a guy.
Yeah, it's like I really don't think the movie works like in an interesting way if you start at the beginning. But I don't know. Maybe the way he pitched it, though, the truth wasn't revealed to the end. Because there's a way. Because really, in some ways, this movie.
End reveal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You could tell this movie kind of exists in a weird way that – it's almost circular because he resets all the time. So you can almost view the end like so it really does.
It almost feels like a time loop movie.
It does.
It's like a mind loop movie.
Because it's through his perspective. It does feel like time travel.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you figure that everything that happened in the movie could have happened before the movie as well. And it could keep repeating itself in a different, way over and over again. So, anyway, he pitched him that. And from what I understood, I watched some videos with Nolan talking about this, and he said that what he was most interesting was the subjective aspect of putting us, the viewer, in the shoes of the main character. And that's the part that he was most challenged by. And that's when he eventually came up with the reverse order idea. He thought that was the best way to put us in the shoes of that character. He couldn't, he thought that would be a kind of challenge and exercise of itself. There were, like I said, this isn't the first story that did this. Like, my big thing when I remember seeing this movie, the first thing I said is, oh, they're ripping off Seinfeld. That was what I think I said.
I know what you're talking about. That episode where they go backwards.
Yeah, they go backwards.
It's a great episode.
It was the same gimmick. And I remember when that episode came out, some of the critics said, oh, they're ripping off Pinter. Pinter had a famous play that did the same thing. And I don't know anything about Pinter, really. Although Pinter comes up every time there's a good gimmick. It seems like Pinter's already done it. If I feel like I should go back and read all the Pinter plays, because every good gimmick seems to be in those plays.
Or the Drew Carey show.
Or the Drew Carey show. There you go. But yeah, so Seinfeld did a reverse episode. I'm sure back in the day, Next Generation did a reverse episode too. Yeah. I just don't remember it. Twilight Zone probably did one for all I know. But the one thing I do appreciate with Memento, like when I take the gimmick, let's talk about other narrative gimmicks, and we'll talk about Groundhog Day, right? That is a narrative gimmick you can kind of apply to different genres, and they've done it many times. And even in Groundhog Day, I wouldn't say, I'm not knocking, I think Groundhog Day is a great movie, but it's not like obvious that you apply a time loop to a story about a guy at Groundhog Day. necessarily. You know, I don't think that's the most obvious choice of a marriage.
You mean the A plus B goes together?
No, right. It's not normal to put those two on the sandwich.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Or if we take Happy Death Day, it's not like, of course you'd have a slasher movie be the one that's in a time. You just apply them and you make a movie, and that's all you care about. This movie, the one thing I'll give it credit for, it found like the perfect subject, even if it was a bit ham-handed and manufactured in a little college movie sort of way. I think it found the perfect marriage of subject and gimmick. Like, yep. I can't think of a better, because, and I think that's why we haven't seen Memento's gimmick used as often as Groundhog Day.
Yep.
Is because there just doesn't exist like another that story that makes sense to tell that
well,
way.
Yeah. There's, you know, well, as far as the injury thing, there's three movies I can think of that have that, right? Like, there's 50 First Dates and then Clean Slate with Dana Carvey.
Holy shit.
Yeah, which I don't know if anyone remembers. Yeah. But like, how many movies can use this thing, you know? Like,
but as far as I think Jamie's talking about just backwards starting in the end and building story. And I agree with you. They found it's emotionally organic, right? Like the experience of it.
And, yes. And because let me tell you, if there was an idea, I would have thought of it by now. Because, you know, it's I would have said Memento storytelling with this genre, this thing, or this storyline. I challenge anybody to come up with a great one. And if you do, you should go write it probably because
the Seinfeld episode is this with comedy.
It is. But
remember the jokes Seinfeld like episode, pay off backwards and stuff?
I don't think the Seinfeld episode is a great marriage of like Groundhog Day is a great marriage of concept. Like I don't see the wedding story that they told and say that must be told backwards.
Yeah.
You know, or that's the
it's
perfect
not emotionally
one.
Impactful right, right. the way without yeah,
but that's like something that came about because it's a weekly show and they had the idea for that, and then they also just had the storyline, you know what I mean, and they pushed them together.
But this, I don't know, I think it's the perfect marriage, and I think that's what separates this one in my mind from other gimmicky kind of devices that have been put on. By the way, I'm cool with gimmicks. Like I think that Seinfeld episode's fun. I love Groundhog Day. I love Happy Death Day. I'm fine with gimmicks. I just think this one really stands out for me as this marriage of like, wow, the right gimmick for this kind of this story is or whatever, this character. So
it's perfect. It's perfect.
It is. It really is.
I agree in that way. What I wanted to bring up was kind of two things that you, when you asked about this, it sort of sparked, and I was like, okay, great. We can, it's like, we have to talk about the gimmick, is there's sort of, because of the gimmick and if you guys have anything bounce off, there's sort of two story engines. Like when you're using a gimmick like this, it then the gimmick itself demands its own set of expectations, like how you're delivering an audience experience depending on the gimmick that you're using. So like we have the A story, which is what is actually happening. That's like if you gave a log line, like that's what it would read like, you know, a man who lost it, who can't remember anything, is trying to put together the puzzle of who killed his wife in order to gain vengeance. You know, that's the A story experience, that's the character experience, and there is, you know, all the story DNA that Jamie talks about in all of our episodes, hero, goal, obstacle, stakes, reward, are all built into that what is the story. But then there's this whole other story engine, which is the how, right? The the story is told, which is the audience experience, the memory loss mystery. We're piecing together the fragments of Leonard's untrustworthy memories, and we have superior position about his future that he does not have because it's backwards. And so that creates this very interesting, unique tension because we want to see how it begins. And so like there's this whole whiteboard just of that has little to do with Leonard's experience and everything to do with our experience as the audience. And I think that's really interesting and different, and also speaks to like how important it is when you come up with a gimmick, the how, when you're going to do something with a how the story is told that's unique, you have to like pay attention to that entire side of the screenwriting. And I read a lot of scripts where it's sort of, if somebody comes up with a gimmick, they come up with a unique how to tell the story. That's sort of the only thing they give a shit about.
Right.
And so we have the opposite problem, which is they're delivering the gimmick like gangbusters. It, like the gimmick is every page is thoughtfully, you know, all there's ideas all over the page, but then they kind of forget about the A story of the character and what the character is going through. And so it's sort of like the gimmick takes center stage. And I feel like this movie's a great example, if you're out there and you have a gimmick, of how it balances both of those things. It gives both of those things equal rate, right? Equal like importance, the character story and then our feelings about it given the gimmick that's happening. Like Deadpool, right? Like Deadpool like is a gimmick, you know, it's like the Ferris Bueller gimmick, the self-aware gimmick, the spoof gimmick, all happening in a way that like it's delivering the how on top of Wade's existing story. So we have Wade's experience of what's happening, and then we have this other experience that's also simultaneously happening, which is Wade talking to us about what's happening, right? So it's like both of those demand their own whiteboards, and they demand their own execution. And I just am constantly seeing people who come up with gimmicks where one or the other whiteboard is kind of just like ignored. So anyway, that's kind of all I wanted to say about it.
Yeah, and this. You know, I have a comment that taps into our next subject, which is kind of why does this thing work in general? And I was struggling with this. So there's this famous Blake Snyder kind of quote that Blake Snyder in his Save the Cat book, he talks about Memento and people ask him about Memento. And then in the end, he says, screw Memento. Even a couple years later, because people to this day say that guy said screw Memento. Well, screw him. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He made, you know, stop or my mom will shoot or whatever.
Blank check.
So years later, somebody wrote him a letter, and it's out on there. If you Google it, I don't have the link handy, but if you Google Memento, Blake Snyder revised thinking or something, or you know, you'll find it. And somebody basically took him to task, and he kind of gave a more thought out version. And his version was kind of along the lines of these kind of movies are college movies and they don't really make money. And if you want to make money in this business, you have to learn to do the other kind of movies too, was kind of his opinion or something. So it's so all like about money and commercial.
He was kind of saying screw it as a teaching.
Exactly. He was kind of like, don't look at this, don't try to emulate this. Now I kind of disagree with that, because I think if you showed up with the Memento script now, that's kind of the thing that sticks out, and you're like, oh, this person. And I think that's what happened with Nolan. It's like, oh, this person is operating on a different level. Everybody Freshness. Else does. Yeah. So I kind of disagree with that. I think Memento is almost the type of thing you want to try to do, but you need to balance it with actual execution and commercialism and stuff like that. But to come up with a really clever idea and execute it is often a way you make a name for yourself. And maybe they never even make this movie, but they hire you for their other weird project or something like that.
Right.
So so that point aside, you know, what this hints at is that Memento is really hard to do a Save the Cat for. And going into this, in the back of my head, I was like, I'm going to try to do a Save the Cat, because it feels like it worked in the past. Like, I hadn't watched it since I read Save the Cat, but I just have a feeling. I do remember this movie being so avant-garde that I was like lost, or, you know, wondering what it was about, or you know what I mean? Or it didn't feel like it was going somewhere. So I was like, I can probably do a Save the Cat for it. But the tricky part of Save the Cat is, especially the way I do Save the Cat. And the way I do Save the Cat is very character driven. So it's about, you know, a hero with a goal and obstacle and stakes. And if you're telling that in reverse, it doesn't work anymore, right? What? Oh God, somebody's attacked somebody.
That's my cat. So this entire time that Jamie's talking about Save the Cat, my cat has been freaking out. And she just busted like something in my office.
Did I hear a cat?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that hilarious?
Save it.
It had a good sound effect to it. There was some kind of thing.
Yeah, it did.
So anyway, the Save the Cat structure, I don't think works as well with something going it backwards because, you know, we already, I don't know. It doesn't make sense on a through line level, the way I do Save the Cat, like, oh, things are worse. Oh, the worst thing happened to him now. But I've actually worked on documentaries and stuff where people brought me in that really weren't as character driven. And I still think Save the Cat's useful to kind of break it down, but kind of divorce yourself a little bit from like the very specifics of a character goes from their ordinary life to the thing, you know, to the upside down world. And instead try to use the beats as what emotion do I get from this? Like, what's the general idea? Mm-hmm. And you kind of divorce yourself. And I think this movie does that. You know, the midpoint is kind of like a twist for the audience.
Yeah.
The All Is Lost is a hit for the audience. The reveal, you know, all that stuff doesn't necessarily have the character arc we're used to. But here's almost the way I looked at this movie this time. I'd have to watch it 10 more times to come up with a theory on this.
Oh, God.
I almost wanted to write. Yeah. I almost wanted to write a log line that was based on us, the viewer, being the main character. And this speaks to your audience experience.
Yeah, that's
good. Yes.
So instead of the typical dramatic question, like, you know, will the hero achieve the goal or will the horrible thing happen? I almost felt like it was, will we find out who actually killed the wife?
Oh, it's almost like a commercial for like a TV show cliffhanger. Will we find out what happens next week?
And you know, if you broke it down, because we have superior position, we can find out, but he never can. And we know that from the end.
Yeah, right.
He never can. But we can because we can go in reverse. So to me, the catalyst is about us learning things. And the break into two is about us going into the unordinary world. Mm-hmm. And the midpoint is about us getting a false victory. And when I viewed it that way, I think it could break down into a Save the Cat PG. Very weird, very strange. But this is a strange, gimmicky movie that goes in reverse. But I think in a weird sort of way, I'm not saying we're the main character, but I think it's so strange being that we're tied to his subjectiveness, but we also have superior position because we can remember what happens in the future.
Exactly.
That we go through an experience and we don't arc or anything or, you know, save the day, but we kind of get all the emotions. We get all the emotions from it that way that a story should tell. That is classic three-act structure. And it's a little
We also know, since we have such a superior position, there's not the emotional ride the same way. You know what I mean? Like, it's not happening. It's not happening to us. We already know what happens. We saw
it. It's funny. I was going to ask you guys, but I might as well just bring it up. Like, I was going to challenge us to come up with what the lock-in was. And based on what you just said, Jamie, I think you sort of validated what I was thinking it was, which is, you know, we open the movie and we see him kill a man, and there's right away the way that it's constructed, we're led to believe that he might be an unreliable narrator and his perspective might be flawed and he might have just killed the wrong guy. So right from the start, the central story question from our experience is,
should he have killed that guy?
Did he kill the right guy?
Right.
Or is there another, you know, explanation for all of this from the A story standpoint? And then when he wakes up in Natalie's bed, which is at 33 minutes, so pretty close to your standard end of act one ish place, when he wakes up, he finds that photo of another bloody guy, and that's the first time we have evidence that there's another person who, you know, fell victim to whatever this investigation is. And his first words when he starts talking to her is, something doesn't feel right. I think someone's fucking with me. Someone's trying to get me to kill the wrong guy. Mm-hmm. That validates that we have had suspicions in every scene leading up to this is sort of you know, playing with those, that question.
Everyone in the movie is manipulating him. I think that the stroke of genius there is the hotel operator cheating him out of a second room. And that kind of like gives the note that everyone in his world is lying.
Yes.
You can't trust anybody. It's just
can't trust anybody.
Yeah.
But in that scene, we are now locked into his problem, which is, yes, it's very fucking possible that he killed the wrong guy. And he even, for once, and by my measurement, because this is what I did a whole watch just looking for this. That's the only time in the movie where he questions his motives. And I think they did that very intentionally for our lock-in, for the audience experience to be like, oh, we at least need one crucial moment where he is questioning his own motives. And the rest of the movie, if you really watch it for that, he's never questioning himself. He's questioning everyone else. And that's tension because like, we're like, are you going to like consider that you might be fucking with yourself? Because we are. But the fact that he isn't creates this extra tension. But anyway, when I was like thinking about it from an audience experience, that really feels like a traditional lock-in, right? There's a problem that by the end of this journey, we're going to understand. There's like a central story question, right? Which is like, did he kill the wrong man? And if not, what's the explanation? And what are the consequences for that explanation? Right. So anyway, it was very to your point, Jamie.
And while he's not investigating that, that's what we're investigating as
we're
watch.
Investigating.
Yeah, it's a separate thing. Yeah.
Yes, that's it. We are investigating all of that.
And it's this type of lesson that a couple times when I've been hired to work on documentaries, sometimes I bring that same style.
Gotcha.
To breaking down the story, because the story doesn't have your typical, this is the hero. And sometimes documentaries, you have to say the world is the hero or something. You know, there's some weird concept of who the hero is. But sometimes I'm like, it's the audience. The audience is the hero in this. And I have to give them those lock-ins, those midpoints, is all is lost, that as if they're the ones discovering the things and not any central character or something like that. So that's the only way I see it as really instructive in some ways. Also, sometimes I should say it's probably instructive in mini plot movies, movies that aren't quite cheeseburgers, that are kind of a little messy. If you want to make a messy movie that doesn't adhere to all these Save the Cat rules, you might adhere to the Save the Cat emotional rules in some ways, or audience expectation rules, and try to figure out what the feeling behind those beats are, even if you're not sticking with, okay, one character going on a hero's journey kind of thing. Yeah.
That's good. Jamie, you made this long list that we sort of haven't gone into of all the reasons that it works. And I like all this list. So you want to kind of talk about them all?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I was trying to figure out, so why, you know, how does it work? Why aren't we bored like 2 seconds in? Because we know the end. And the vast majority of it is, some of us aren't bored 2 seconds in. Why does this thing work? And I think most of it comes down to, and I've talked about this before, is the thing that keeps us flipping pages in a book or keeps us watching the next episode of a show or the next 5 minutes is tension. I think tension is the engine for storytelling. Yeah. And sometimes it's just planting itches that need to be scratched. That can be a form of tension. You just give something that somebody wants to be complete and answered.
There's never a moment without a why. There's never a moment without a question in this movie whatsoever. Like every moment is a question. Every single thing is a question.
You're absolutely right. And there are a bunch of ways. Like, I think Nolan and the Nolans and the script work overtime on tension in this. I think they know this, like, so they're trying to do all kinds of things. So in some ways, there's those big questions that we just talked about, the lock-in, you know, did he kill somebody? What would the consequences be? What's the emotional toll of that? Or, you know, what's his culpability or whatever? Mm-hmm. Who's behind it? Who killed the wife? What's really going on? All those things are itches we need scratched as the story progresses. So they're the kind of macro level. And then there's scene to scene. He does the thing I've talked about before, which I love writing the beginning of movies. And I love watching the beginning of movies and television shows, because I think the audience gives you buy-in for about 2 to 3 minutes of confusion. And the audience is participating in trying to figure out, who's that guy? Why are they mad at them? Who's this other person? Why am I here? What am I doing? And this movie, because every scene opens up like the start of a movie almost, it's the start of a new story. Yeah. And he has no idea. He's like the audience in some ways, where he's like, why am I in the bathroom? Who's this guy knocked out? You know, all that stuff.
Yep.
So we're piecing all that stuff together in every single new section. And that's fun. That's that mystery tension
for you and I, but Bob is exhausted by it.
No, my comments were more about just the character of Leonard,
right?
Like the stuff you said. Yeah. I don't think he's a good person, and also his condition just makes me not interested.
Gotcha.
I don't care. To me, he's just almost a monster. You could point in any direction to kill anyone because of his condition. So I'm kind of like, I don't really care what happens. That was my comment at the beginning.
Gotcha.
Worse, but for some reason,
great. Yeah.
Yeah. Even worse, for some reason, his character seems like a real, like, boring dude. You know, it's like,
Guy Pearce is a very charismatic actor, and this is maybe one of his more boring portrayals.
Yeah. Yeah.
It really is.
I had no idea this shade was coming. I love it.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, it's just not a movie with person. It's got the personality is all in the gimmick. It's not in the main character whatsoever. It's just he's a blank slate. Unlike, he's like
he is intentionally because that's how they make this work. Yeah.
Now, if Dana Carvey, the blank slate, he was full of personality. So
I like clean slate more than this.
Clean slate, we're told in reverse. It would be the perfect movie.
Yeah, it would be much bigger.
Jamie, when you were talking about the tension, you made me think of those questions I brought up to you guys off the episode before we started, which is like, there are like beyond like, where is he? Why is he here? What is he doing? Why is he doing what he's doing? Is he safe? Is he in danger? We feel that in every scene. And he even vocalizes that. Awake, where am I? Who is this person? Do I know them? They seem to know me. Why do they know me? Can I trust them? Like, that is very impactful and makes you you're doing all these mental gymnastics with him to be like, what's going to orient yourself? But also once we get to that lock in and they've set up the whole world and all the people that are in the world and all those, everything we know, we have like these six core questions that every single scene addresses in some way. And I think that's like very instructive. They have like six different mysteries happening, which is the murder investigation agenda. Did Lenny kill the right man, or was his vengeance unjustified, right? That's your A story.
Right.
And then is Teddy the man who killed Lenny's wife, or is Lenny's whole investigation untrustworthy? Is Natalie trustworthy? Does she somehow have something to do with killing his wife, or is she just manipulating Lender for her own needs? Is Leonard's memory trustworthy, or is he like Sammy Jenkins and incapable of making new memories? Therefore, is he just in an unreliable narrator with unintentionally sending us and himself on a wild goose chase? Or is Lenny a dishonest protagonist who's manipulating himself this entire time on purpose? Or how did he get these Polaroid clues? Are they true? Are they progress? Are they dead ends? Are they untrustworthy lies given to him by others? Are they untrustworthy lies given to him by himself? And all of that, that's a shit ton of like things to think about, participate, look for cues and answers to. And every single one of those questions is like present at all times in every scene. So I think that's very instructive that like, if you have a mystery, how many of these questions can you like plant the seeds for like tension and answers to that you can keep bringing up? It's that status update thing that we talk about a lot. Or, like, we need to give the audience like status updates. It could be like setbacks. Oh shit. Like this is different than I thought. And they're like, oh, this is exactly what he's been looking for. And I've been looking for. Yeah. Anyway,
I was going to say, I told you guys before this, I saw the breakdown summary of it in proper order. Like somebody broke it down in proper order. I didn't watch the entire movie like that, but all that stuff you just said kind of goes away.
Yeah.
Like most of it goes away completely. Right. Like it just does not work.
If you tell it linearly.
It's actually really a bland story of people just lying to a guy. Nothing's really it's not like that gripping. And so
I think Jonathan Nolan's short story is out there. You can go find it. And I bet you I've never read it. So this is just, you know, people listening to this who have read it are going to be like, you're wrong. But there's a way to tell this story that it does have mystery and stuff if you tell it in the other order. It's just not this way. You know, this way
is
geared towards telling that. I would have to guess that his story doesn't start out like, I'm going to lie to myself and do this thing and then set off a course of events kind of thing. If it does, I don't know. So the thing to Jimmy's point too, and these are many kind of things that happen all along, is there's tons of, I'm calling them just as a joke, payoff setups, but they're really not payoff in the beginning. I'm just reversing the order. But even little things like the Polaroid, like where does this Polaroid? We know we're going to see it. It's a Chekhov's Polaroid. Right. You know, it's sitting there for us. And then he might have writing on it. And we'll be like, oh, we need to see the moment he writes that. Or it might have writing crossed off. And we want to see them. What he crossed off? Like, why was it crossed off? Did he do it? Did somebody else do it? Is it a trick? And there's tons of little moments. Like every second of the thing is almost like a payoff that could be set up earlier. Whether he's in a place where he meets somebody and he's like, you know, like when she says, you don't remember me, do you? And then we know, oh, there's a scene where we're going to get where they were together.
The laugh payoff. And then the next scene, they spit in the drink we saw him drink and then get laughed at. And we don't know why they're laughing at him. My favorite one, to your point, is the pens. They get into an argument in her house and she starts gathering the pens. And then we see the scene before that she's planning on manipulating him. So she doesn't want him to have the pens so that he can write the lie that he just discovered about her. So that was like, we got this payoff of her taking the pens. And then the next scene gives us the setup for that. So, yeah.
I think a little bit of my problem, if I'm the critical in this episode, is that I think that some of the other characters are a little too clever and trustworthy with his ailment. I'm like, I don't think most people would react as fast as they do and understand how things work as fast as they do as they do in the movie. And I find that, especially Natalie, I find it a little bit unbelievable that she'd be so quick to just be like, I can use this guy as my own thing.
I'm just like, catches on real fast.
It doesn't read well for me. I'm like, you're just on board with this guy's ailment and believe him and
So you don't think it earns that level of
Joey Pants, his thing totally makes sense to me.
Yeah.
He's a cop. He understands the ailment. He's been on board since day one. Jumping into the story like this is where the movie kind of loses me, to be honest.
Gotcha.
You know, I think there's I think it almost feels like extra I don't need. I think.
It's there to make you think other things, you know, like,
in my opinion, it's there to confuse further. I just don't like her portion of the movie that much. That's just me. You know, I know I'm going to get crap for this. I know.
No, you're not.
Yeah, I know.
I'm just really surprised.
And then the other thing I just wanted to mention was the B story, and I'm calling the B story the black and white story.
The objective story, call it that, because that's how it's filmed. Yes. It's filmed objectively.
Mm-hmm. And it's mostly just exposition and telling a story, basically. But we're following a story, and it has little cliffhangers that we're waiting to hear the next part of. So that kind of gives it its own momentum, because that's traveling in the normal direction we're used to. And you could probably break that down into a series of beats in itself if you wanted to. So it kind of, and when you have a movie like this that is a little bit off the beaten path and jumbling things, sometimes to have the B story take over and give a narrative that's like, we can just settle in and understand what it's doing, can help kind of organize things a little bit in some ways. Oppenheimer uses the same technique. The black and white scenes are kind of the, you know, he kind of does a similar thing. Yeah, he brings
it is with a, the, subjective and objective with that Oppenheimer too. It's the same thing.
So I did not know.
It is.
Like everything black and white is when Oppenheimer is not there or somebody else is the key, you know?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And it kind of does the same thing where the color plot in Oppenheimer is a little bit, I wouldn't say scattered, but it's kind of mini plot. It's a history almost. It's a history. It's less of a story and more of a history. A little like The Social Network. When we want, you know, when you come back to the different deposition scenes, you know,
right?
The deposition scenes are almost like a mini or a real. I shouldn't say mini because that throws it off. A short film about a deposition.
Yeah, they're a wraparound, and it's this. These black and white scenes definitely function like a wraparound, and then the wraparound meets the other stuff in the end. Yeah.
Oppenheimer does the same thing, except, well, I won't talk about Oppenheimer because people might not have seen it, but it does a similar thing, but I think it gives more weight. It gives more weight to the black and white scenes is the only thing I'll say. And really not a spoiler, just a technique. But anyway, so I think that's another trick they're using to make this all work, plot work.
Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to add the vengeance stuff because I felt like we might as well, you know, talk about that. It's definitely built into all of these emotional part of the experience, which is, you know, when you have a character who has a vengeance agenda, that comes with a different set of typical, like, you know, we've talked about how like Star Wars is like, you know, the goal is to like destroy the Death Star. The reward is to like, you know, defeat, eliminate the Empire. You know, the stakes is like, you know, the Empire, you know, fascism winning. You know, that's like a much bigger thing. When you have like a character who wants vengeance, it's basically just that, right? Like if they don't get vengeance, then they suffer internally. And if they get vengeance, they feel like they'll feel better, you know? So it's like its own different experience. And
we have a protagonist that can never feel it.
Right. They can't even remember.
Even
the whole movie builds to confirming that. Yeah.
That's what Joey Pants is saying at the end. He's like, even if he did, he couldn't remember. It doesn't matter.
Which makes it all like a meaningless exercise, basically, from in that standpoint.
Hence but my
position. I know. But it's tragedy, man. It's a tragedy. But you know, I do think this movie has the payback clock, which we've talked about, which is like, when vengeance is the agenda, when vengeance are the stakes, then you have this ever-present urgency from the character to achieve their goal, even if there isn't a clock, even if there isn't a deadline. The deadline is already up.
It's almost a comic obsession, right? It's similar to that, right?
And I think this movie does a great example of the payback clock, right? Like there's ever-present urgency from Leonard to get that vengeance, to, you know, seek justice for the death of his wife and for the injury of his brain. And he is driven by this shit to, like you said, it's instead of a comic obsession, it's a dangerous obsession, right? And it's like, it's what's driving him this entire story. And I just wanted to make one other note before we move on to the next thing, which is when we've done the other vengeance movies, we sort of came to this observation that inherent to a vengeance story is a protagonist of few words. John Wick, The Man with No Name, The Bride, Eric Draven, Dwight and Blue Ruin, Robin and Pig. All these vengeance stories, usually the character doesn't say much. They don't really talk. And we have to learn about them through other characters. This one, he never fucking stops talking like for the duration of the movie. I thought that was like an interesting subversion to me felt intentional. Like I'm going to have a vengeance story where the character who wants vengeance never stops fucking talking about it. So I thought that was interesting that I didn't remember from the movie.
I wanted to add something to your vengeance thing too. What I do like about the movie is that essentially, when we get to the end, after the whole movie has the vengeance stakes that we're familiar with, we learn that he actually he is a vengeful person innately, because when he learned the truth from Joey Pants, he lied to himself.
Yes.
To get vengeance on that guy for a different thing and completely, thus setting up all these other events. So we're actually watching a totally different path of vengeance that he's not even aware of. Yep. You know what I'm saying? Because of the car and, you know, like what's happening with he like lied to himself to kill him. It's like vengeance for another reason. That's all I'm saying. It's like he's a vengeful innately a person if he didn't have the brain.
Right.
Thing.
Right.
Yeah.
We learned that he sucks, basically.
Yes. Yeah. But the vengeance,
which I would argue is like a worst case future outcome that we've been supposed to have been feeling this entire time. Like, I really hope that it doesn't turn out that he sucks and that he's.
But it's not just that he's wrong about killing the guy. He did it.
Yeah.
He killed him for the reason he found out the reason he was lying to him and then set in motion.
He got
the event
what he wanted
to kill him for a reason that has nothing to do with his wife.
Yes.
He killed him because he was lying to him and using him.
Yeah.
So it's a different. It's almost a different vengeance story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Do we want to do that? We talked about the last one, right?
Well, I want to. Which one
quote.
Is that? There's oh, a, yeah, yeah.
We talked about the quote.
Yeah.
Did you want to? Is there anything else on this list that you wanted to talk about when the subjective filmmaking list?
No, I think that's
it. Oh, I thought, I didn't know. Jimmy said there was one more.
It was the one you just skipped over.
Well, we talked about that, right?
Yeah, we talked about it first.
Gotcha. Agenda checkpoints.
Yeah, so Jamie, you touched upon this. I was going to just jump in right then, but I thought I'd just wait a bit. So I would say, and it sounds like you were picking this up too when you, you know, looked at it from the audience experience and said, well, it does have sort of, it does, you feel like you could make a traditional arc plot story outline from the perspective of the audience's emotional experience about these events, right? And about uncovering this mystery. And to that point, I think for all of the subversive approach to the story and the way it's told, it has a very traditional arc plot set of like those checkpoints where we need these moments as the story's unfolding in a traditional cheeseburger Hollywood movie where the story stops and the characters talk about the overall goal and agenda, and they give the audience a checkpoint, a status update, like mile markers to be like, we're getting closer to figuring this out, you know, or we're getting farther away. And, oh, like things are getting harder. You know, the goal, reward, stakes, obstacles, and urgency is discussed very like clearly to the audience, and then we have our fingers on the pulse of like how close the hero is or how much further they are from achieving their goal. And here the Polaroids and the tattoos, in my opinion, are very much like a cheeseburger forward momentum story, even though it's giving us the events of how those Polaroids were created and how those things, why those things were written on it. It's happening backwards. It feels like it's forward. Like it's what's giving the whole story momentum is like, okay, like what, how, where did this Polaroid come from? Like you said, Jamie, like what is the message on there? What is behind that message? Is it a clue that's trustworthy?
And then going back in time answers the question we had about then, but in our experience, it's forward.
It's forward, right. Yeah, for us, it's a forward answer for him. Yes. So I think that for all of its subversion, there's a forward momentum, like arc plot where set of goal checkpoints, like, oh, here's a status update at the end of act one. And the Polaroid is 100% the way that the writer gives you like a visual evidence to support that. Right. It's like the detective whiteboard, the detective board with, memento premise paint is the Polaroids and tattoos, right? Like, and he even has a board, but the board is basically his body. And then we're going through the movie trying to figure out each piece of that detective board and what it means and how it got there and whether it's trustworthy, you know? And I think that all, if you track this movie at all of the standard Hollywood beats, right? Your 50% midpoint, your 75%, like for instance, like at the midpoint or around the midpoint, 66 minutes is when Joey Pants Teddy, whatever his real name is in the story, Teddy, you know, says it starts. Our question again, our overall story, central story question from the audience's perspective is, did he kill the right guy? Right. Or is there another explanation? Teddy comes in the car and basically tells him, you better start asking yourself if there's any truth to this investigation. He says, first of all, he says, you can't trust Natalie. Write this down. Don't trust her, which is our own suspicions, right? And that's the first time anyone in the story has said that. So Teddy is saying to Leonard the very thing we are fearing. Can't trust her. Then Teddy also starts talking about this investigation and how he's concerned about Leonard's obsession with it, right? And he's like, maybe you should start investigating yourself is what. So this is like at the very midpoint, right? That's like a very clear update for us. Yes. Now, even the characters are saying the things that we ourselves are concerned about, you know, where this is going. And then they use the Polaroids. After Teddy leaves, he looks at the dual right. Polaroids. Natalie says, do not trust her. Teddy says, don't believe his lies. And he makes a meaningful choice and scratches out the do not trust her and just says, Joey Pats is the one lying to me, not right. Natalie. And so we have this shift. And that's very much, you know, how a traditional arc plot Hollywood midpoint works, right? That propels us into the rest of the story. And then at the end, at 91 minutes, so again, like right there at your traditional 2-hour movie, 90-ish minutes is your standard 75% end of act two. We get another scene where Teddy basically has an escalated version of the argument they had in the car. And he's like doubling down on all the things about the investigation. And once again, sort of like challenging him, you know, like, you're fucking crazy. Like, you need to start, you know, you need to keep getting more serious about thinking about whether this is what you want to keep doing, you know, even though he hasn't told him the full truth. And then when he leaves, Leonard looks at his photo that says, don't believe his lies. And he says, you're full of shit, Teddy, to himself. So we get that status update, like, okay, he's not getting closer to believing that he's lying and that this is all bullshit, but we are, you know what I mean? We get our standard right. And, but the photo is what is used to sort of solidify that we have a big update in the story. So anyway, I think that for everything that it's weird, the photos and the tattoos are very arc plot, like forward momentum. It's very weird in that way. But I would ask yourself, what is my story's version, even in a regular linear story? What is my story's version of the photos and tattoos that give the audience an easy to understand status update about how close we are or far we are from achieving the goal? And that's what I would say.
Gotcha. Okay. That's not easy. No, Jimmy, good job, because that's not easy to say what
it's
you just said.
It's hard to explain what I'm trying to, but
that's
kind of
what the whole thing with this movie.
I think that's instructive, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Trying to voice the instructive nature of this movie is itself a puzzle. I think just listening to you guys is pretty obvious. Let's talk about Remember Sammy Jenkins.
Yeah.
Stephen Tobolowsky from Groundhog Day. Yeah. Ned?
I totally forgot Ned Ryerson is in this. Jamie, I know this is my talking point, but you did bring up a lot of good points about the B story already. And I just want to talk about it. To me, we haven't spent much time talking about like thematic subplots.
No.
I think that, am I wrong? Like, I think this is a good example of those. Am I going the wrong direction here, Jamie, or do you think this is a good thematic subplot?
Well, I'm interested to hear your breakdown of the theme, because it is tricky for me, and I think that's why it leaves me a little. But subplots, you know, in the Save the Cat world, the B story is always, which is a subplot, which is should always be about theme first. It's a more on the nose version of the theme. So once again, it's
checking those traditional boxes, but just delivering the flavor in a different way than we are used to. Yeah.
Right.
But right. No, so like one way it reminded me of like it's a more clear thematic subplot in my opinion than Nope. It reminded me of like the chimp side thing in Nope, where you have this story that's not really related to what's happening, but is related to what's happening, you know, and you're like, what is the purpose of this? Well, the purpose of this is like when you're coming up with ideas and you're trying to find ways to force the characters to like make observations about themselves and their problems and grow and change. One way to do that is to create like worst case future or worst case present self reflections. And like the Sammy Jenkins story, which we find out is kind of just him anyway. But for most of the movie, the Sammy Jenkins story he's telling is a reflection of himself in that he's describing a scenario that shows the audience what's going to happen in like the self-destructive nature of this agenda, right? Of this investigative. Like if Leonard doesn't figure out that his mind is fucked and he should stop paying attention to what his mind is telling him to do obsessively, then it's going to lead to people dying. Just like Sammy Jenkins's situation, he himself was tasked with basically validating this guy's mental health problems. And instead he was like, no, he does have the power to make new memories and be a more normal person, which caused his wife to basically self-sabotage everything and ended up killing her, right? So right. I and there's some great lines here that the script says that I think point to what they're trying to do with this. Like they're trying to teach, basically Leonard is trying to teach himself a lesson, like past Leonard before the story begins, because we learn in the end, I was waiting to see if he would tattoo it during that big climactic moment where we learn he's lying to himself, you know? But in the end, we see that he's already has the tattoo that says, remember Sammy Jenkins, which basically, in my opinion, is like showing us that an earlier version of Leonard recognizes that he's on the wrong path by following this insane murder mystery. And that remember Sammy Jenkins is meant to make him go like, I need to fucking stop being crazy and just like accept my condition and move on with my life, you know, because if Sammy Jenkins's wife had accepted his condition and moved on, she'd still be alive and Sammy wouldn't be in an institution, you know? And he has this line that he's saying to the cop in the end, after all that story, it's one of the last lines he says before the B story catches up with the A story. He says, I was wrong about Sammy and I was wrong about his wife. She wasn't interested in the money. She just needed to understand his problem. His brain didn't respond to conditioning, but he also wasn't a con man and I was wrong. And I think like he himself is like saying right there, like he just needs to understand that his brain doesn't work anymore. And he just needs to like accept that and stop trying to like be normal. You know what I mean? And I don't know. I think that is there. I think it's measurable. I think there's a bunch of lines that I didn't pull that are like also Leonard saying that as he's sharing the Sammy Jenkins story, sort of coming to that conclusion over the course of the story. And I don't know, I think the movie is, like, I think there is a want and need here. I think Jamie, do you want to kind of talk about want versus need, and then I'll kind of share what I think it is?
Yeah, sure. So want versus need, in Save the Cat terms, we usually talk about the big three, which is flaw, which I'll talk about in a second in relation to the need, want and need. So the want is usually the thing that character thinks will make them happy, that's the want. And it's usually based on the flaw that they have. The need is the lesson they need to learn to really make them happy. So that's what kind of where you get the want and the need. So the want is almost a wrongheaded thing usually, sometimes not even wrongheaded, but sometimes just not as nuanced as what they really need to have happened.
Right.
And the need is that lesson, that character arc.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think there is a want. I wasn't expecting to bring this out but of the movie, but the B story seems so clearly to be about this for me, like a thematic subplot that's like solely exists to teach the audience the lesson that Leonard doesn't learn, which is his want is to find his wife's killer and the man who injured his brain and get vengeance and kill him. His need is self-acceptance, to accept the severity of his condition and move forward and not become what happened to Sammy Jenkins and his wife or what he believes, you know? So I think that's definitely there. Like, it's a tragedy. He doesn't learn that. And therefore the movie ends tragically, you know, like he goes the wrong way. So, and anyway, I thought that was interesting that I observed that, and I didn't know if you felt it tracks or.
It tracks. He ends up using himself as a weapon.
Yeah.
Like I said earlier, he deliberately uses himself to kill someone. That's the opposite lesson than taking care of your disease.
Right. It's he goes heavily
the other way. So,
and this is kind of where the loop works for me for a tragedy. So a tragedy is typically a movie where they don't learn the lesson and horrible things result. But because I feel like something similar could happen either before or after the movie, again, I feel like in a weird sort of way, that tragedy is still earned in reverse as it would be in forward. Yeah.
But I feel like it's there. So I just felt like talking about it a little bit. But
do you, secondary question, you said you had a really good, Jimmy, you're saying you had a really good grasp on the reality.
I wanted to talk about this since you said Nolan talks about this. Okay.
What was your answer? What is your personal answer to the Sammy Jenkins reality? Like, is it?
That's
what you were trying to say.
No, I was talking about the unreliable narrator part of the equation, which is similar. Like, he's making that up, you know, to an extent. But so I kind of wanted to talk real quick about, because this is a subject that when it comes up we sort of have a nice debate, and I feel like since Bob, before we started, you shared that you heard Nolan talking about this, that
I think me and Jamie watched the same video.
Oh shit, yeah, I didn't
watch Nolan it. At a chalkboard, okay. Jamie, right?
Yeah, and I watched that too. It gives a really horrible like visual, like he says it's like a hairpin. I'm like, why would anybody do it that way? Yeah. He draws like a hairpin. Yeah.
It's really confusing.
Okay. It's very confusing.
Okay, so I have I'm gonna try to, again, this is a complex thing that I'm trying to like do in layman's terms.
Next episode we're doing Tenet.
My God, thank God we didn't do that. Bring on something like so easy to spoon feed.
Clean slate.
Yeah.
Clean slate.
So if you if you like this, we talk about this at length in the Joker episode. If you want to hear more like discussion between the three of us about this topic, which is there are two types of a lot of people confuse unreliable narrators with dishonest protagonists. And they are two different types of experiences that demand two different types of like audience manipulation and all the storytelling ingredients that come along with that. So the difference, and this is why this movie is interesting, with the way it handles it. The difference between the unreliable narrator and the dishonest protagonist is the character's intent to deceive. So, Verbal Kent in The Usual Suspects is a dishonest protagonist. He's not an unreliable narrator. He knows he's lying. He's lying to all the characters. He's lying to us. The entire thing is a lie on purpose, including a lie to us. He's not crazy. He knows exactly what he's doing. He's a dishonest protagonist.
I mean, the ending of the movie literally is that's the twist, right?
Ed Norton in Fight Club is an unreliable narrator. He's out of his mind. He doesn't know what his reality is. He doesn't know he's lying to himself, and he doesn't know he's lying to the audience. So that's why he's an unreliable narrator. He does not know he's lying, and the story is not lying to us from his character's perspective. Joaquin Phoenix's Joker is an unreliable character because the whole story is him in Arkham Asylum talking to a nurse, and he's out of his mind and he doesn't realize he's lying to the characters in the audience. So the entire story is a lie, but he doesn't know it's a lie. He's just fucking crazy. So everything we're seeing is unreliable, but it's not, he's not being a dishonest protagonist, that the whole movie isn't lying to us just to fucking pull the rug out under us, right? This one, so dishonest protagonists lie to the audience and the characters on purpose. Unreliable narrators do not know that they're lying. It is discovered by either us or them or both near by the end that their perspective wasn't trustworthy, right?
Right.
So the thing that's interesting about this is from scene one, we know he's an unreliable narrator. We are told very clearly he's fucking crazy and his perspective is so fragmented that it cannot be trusted, which is fresh and subversive to know right from the start. This guy's an unreliable narrator. There's nothing you have to figure out, right? And the entire movie, we are made...
There's nothing you have to figure out, but the whole movie's figuring it out.
Yeah. We are so the seed of doubt is planted right there from the start, and the entire time we're like, I can't trust his perspective, he's a fucking unreliable perspective. You know, we're made to believe he's an unreliable narrator the entire time, but the reveal is that he's a fucking dishonest protagonist that planted the lie, and what the entire thing, he was lying on purpose from the start. Therefore the whole movie is actually him being a dishonest protagonist. So it's very interesting and weird and hard to describe and hard to unpack. But in my opinion, that's like what's happening here.
There is even like possibilities that the wife story, I mean, right? Like the whole point of the whole thing might not have happened the way we thought it happened, right?
Right, right.
It could have been totally different.
Yeah. What I thought you were bringing up, Bob, was because what did you say Nolan said about it, about this topic?
Oh, he just said he refuses to give concrete answers about what is.
And for me, heard that, I was like, I thought it was concrete that he chose to lie to himself. He created false clues. He sent himself on a wild goose chase. It's very clear to me that the entire thing was
He's happy to talk about the film and the structure and everything, but he refuses to say what actually happened. Gotcha. It's up to us. And I think that's, you know.
Gotcha. I don't think there's much to figure out besides the Sammy Jenkins story. You know, like, I guess for me is like, is he saying
go ahead. I agree. I think you're right. I think it's like saying, I think it's him being kind of like
cheeky.
Pretentious filmmaker. In some ways, like I don't know,
like I'm just supposed to be confused by that statement, though I wasn't confused by what was happening.
Once I'm done with the movie, it belongs to the audience or something like
that's
that.
Fine.
Okay. To me, that's where because I agree with you. It's kind of like if the director of Liar Liar at the end said, you know, I don't give any concrete answers. Like
concrete answers to what?
What? You know, the Parent Trap. And we're like,
We saw him write the fake clue that he gets tattooed.
Right.
We saw
him.
Yeah. Like we heard him state why he was doing it to himself.
In a different context.
Yeah.
It wasn't exactly to this point. I think it was more meaning if Sammy Jenkins was him versus if he was actually an insurance investigator and all that, versus was Sammy Jenkins.
There is some ambiguity there,
right? Because there's the shot of him in the mental asylum for like 1 second.
Yeah, there is some of that 12 Monkeys Fight Club-ish stuff,
right?
Yeah.
So that's more what I think I meant is like he wasn't willing to say if that was true or not. I didn't necessarily mean about it, the thing you're talking about, the unreliable
narrator versus dishonest protagonist.
Yeah.
So anyway, I thought it was fresh and interesting in the way it handled that part of the recipe, you know, by telling us from scene one that he's an unreliable narrator, and then in my opinion, revealing that he was a fucking lying, dishonest protagonist the whole time. I think that's very interesting.
Well, he's kind of both. I mean, he is both. His condition makes him an unreliable narrator.
In the end, he's both, which is unique.
Right. It's frustrating. I think that's everything.
Yeah, for a complex movie,
it's a very short. unless you guys had something else on Memento,
Memento. I think we covered a lot.
Besides,
I hope I did better than 19-year-old me did,
I did look up. Yeah.
I did look up the article, Blake's second take on Christopher Nolan's Memento on the Save the Cat website. So if you want to Google it, that's Blake's second take.
Okay. So, if we're done with our Memento discussion, we did have a listener question.
Yes.
That was actually emailed to us, to our email, which is writersblockbusterspodcast@gmail.com. So if you have a question, you can email us and we will address it. So let's get into this one question. It's from listener Thomas Havernack Jr. And he said, I had a question for Jamie regarding a very old episode, The Mitchells versus the Machines. At 47:55 mark, you guys are discussing the flash forward prologue, which in this movie teases the promise of the premise. Jamie mentioned that he feels the flash forward prologue is a bit of a cheat. I was curious if you feel this way regardless of how it is done, or if there are examples where this has been done well. Are there certain circumstances that justify its use? Or is it simply considered bad practice? Thanks, and my best to you all.
Yeah, I've never seen that movie, so I'm not sure.
All right, bye, everybody.
he did the episode without ever watching the movie. Jamie's that good, man.
That's right. So that movie, it starts out with like a tease that happens much later in the movie. So it flashes forward to a tease of like robot apocalypse and the family escaping and all that kind of stuff. And it has kind of a voiceover of the character, like, this is my dad and this is my, you know, and how do we get here and blah, blah, blah. And then it goes to the setup, which is before the apocalypse. Mm. So it's one of the movies that does that.
Almost like a TV approach.
Yeah, a TV approach. I was going to say, there's a thing in television I call, in my television book, called the opening pitch. And the opening pitch of a pilot, the opening scene, the kind of cold open, a lot of TV shows use that technique. A lot of them. They kind of give you a voiceover, almost a pitch of the whole show. Like, you know, here, this is my family. We live in this house and we do this and we do that. And sometimes it is even a flash forward. Sometimes because they know, like if it's an action show, for example, they know they need to give you like 10 minutes of setup and they don't want you to turn the channel. Mm-hmm. They don't want you switching. I think some of that is kind of what's going on here. And you know, it's probably a Netflix mandate that they need something grabbing. You know, it's like, I'm not saying that Netflix came in and said, put this in the beginning, but they're probably thinking in those terms. Like, mm-hmm. we can't have, because if you remember Mitchell versus the Machines, it's a weird movie in that there's almost a movie before the movie that happens where she's going away to college and they go on a trip and there's a debate. Yeah, yeah. So it takes a long time to get to robot apocalypse.
To the hook. Okay.
For a kids movie. So in this case, they're putting something to say, hold on, here's what it looks like.
This is what we're getting to. Yeah.
And to their credit, well, I do think those kind of scenes, when I typically read them, are a bit of a cheat. Sometimes you have to cheat. I mean, there's reasons for it. I get the reasons. And to their credit, they did a good job with the girl's voice. There's a lot of good gags and jokes and things like that punch it up. And I like that part about it. Like a lot of the flash forwards I see when I read like script consulting scripts are like, man is tied to a chair. I'm going to kill you. That's it. You know, and it's like, you know, 5 days earlier and that's it. That's all they give you, you know? And it's like, yeah, I get why you did it, but you know, wasn't there something else you could have done? And it never feels like that's the choice you'd make in a vacuum, like telling a story. Like if I was telling you guys the story of something that happened, I don't think I'd ever do a flash forward. I don't think I'd ever be like
verbal.
And then
like
I was
verbally
tied to the chair 5 days earlier.
I see.
There's something that it always feels like an after the fact idea or an idea that you just didn't have any other way to start it with a kind of grabbing thing that you had to come up with something in the end, and that was,
I mean, isn't the lesser of all evils. Isn't it already cliche that people hate? It's the, you're probably wondering how I got here. Like, this kind of, yeah, like, exactly. Right? Like, it's,
yep, yep.
And people hate that. So,
and so I'm not saying, and I'm sure there's good examples. Can you think of a good example off the top of your head?
It just, like, you, everything that he described in his question made me think of, like, the endless TV teaser
Buffy
examples.
Episodes, man. That's like, yeah, they all do that. Yeah.
That it's like
TV does it all the time.
Yeah. Breaking and it works. Bad.
But that, right? Makes, yeah, it makes sense, yeah, for TV. Like you said, they want to grab people's attention. So that's almost, like, a function of the format. Then,
like,
you know,
yeah, like Better Call Saul is a good, yeah, example. Yeah. They use, very much like Memento or Oppenheimer, they use the black and white kind of thing. Like, here he is in the future. We'll get here eventually. Let's connect the dots of the, yep, two things, you know, as we go. And it becomes a device in those shows, where in the worst of them, it's not really a device. It's just like, oh, we need to give them some action in the first 2 seconds. So let's give it to them.
But my pushback, you know, it's not really pushback against anybody, any of either of you, but is to our own saying, maybe you shouldn't do it, is I always enjoy it in TV, you know? So why can't you make it work in movies? You know what I mean? Like, I always like the teaser, you know, that functions like that. So
doesn't yeah. Fight Club open with one?
Maybe. Yes, it does. Yeah. It's relevant to
we
this
just mentioned
episode.
Fight Club. It open, yeah,
no, Fight Club does that.
It does
open that
one.
Way.
Yeah.
There you go.
There's probably a lot more examples that I just can't pull from my brain right now, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, it's a good question.
Yeah.
Weirdly enough, like, it made me reflect on, because I don't, kind of like you guys say, I don't necessarily hate it. To me, though, just me personally, I feel like the only way I'd arrive at it is if I surrendered all other options.
Ah, okay.
That's the way I personally would arrive.
Okay.
Maybe back in the day when I was really getting, like, I wanted to give it a voice and I wanted to open up with something, maybe I'd come up with an image and then flashback. But I was trying to think of in my own screenplays, and I've written, again, I've said this a million times, but I've written over 100 at this point. I don't think I've ever started with a flash forward. Yeah. So it could just be a personal
time,
thing.
Jamie, the pickleball championships.
I would only do it to make fun of flash forwards. You know what I mean? Like, that's the only reason I could think why I would want to do something like that.
Okay.
I may have done something like that in one of my scripts.
Like, yeah, satire. I'm sure I did. Basically, but
I'm sure I've done it somewhere, but I just can't remember.
But for this example, it works in the Mitchells versus the Machines. Definitely.
I think there's reasons for it, mm-hmm. and it's not boring. And that's the thing. It's not like these scenes, like Jimmy said, it's not that these scenes are boring or you don't like it. It's just, I don't know. I'm more talking about some writer intention in me. I just always, it would always be my last choice.
Yeah.
But I think also you could be right, Jamie. It could be like a Netflix note.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And that's fine. Yes. It happens. Yeah. That's how movies get made.
That's no different than the teaser before the trailer, right? You got the 5-second trailer.
Oh, yeah, right.
At the front, you know, then I can see the Netflix boardroom having those same standards, right? It's got to have the trailer for the movie at the front end of the movie. Yeah.
Right.
And they probably have data, you know, they probably have, like, look, this is the arc of how many people will drop off if you don't do the thing. Mm-hmm. You know,
I mean, you know, in an episode where Jamie's talking about becoming a TikToker, our attention spans are worse than they've ever been in history.
Yeah.
You gotta,
so maybe so we will start seeing this more often.
So if you're making a movie about, like, your mom exploding, maybe they want to show her exploding right at the top. And then you work your way to the explosion. You know, just our attention spans are gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the teaser trailer in front of the trailer is exactly what I was thinking of, Jimmy.
Yeah.
It's the worst thing ever.
And what the question is, I agree.
It's disgusting. I hate it.
I hate it so much, too. But what the listener is describing from Mitchells and Machines is the cinema version of that, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. The teaser for the movie before the actual, while the actual movie is beginning.
Like, it hasn't gotten that bad that we need to do that.
I feel like we need to construct a concept where the lead character is watching the teaser of the movie before.
Oh my gosh.
Maybe this is explanation of why the Mission Impossible movies have lasted so long, because they got the format of the TV show where they show all the shots from the movie in the opening theme song.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they show what's coming in the movie.
Yeah, they absolutely do.
And then you watch the movie, you know?
Yeah. Well,
I just don't remember Mission Impossible well enough. They don't do like a little James Bond cold open kind of thing in those movies. I don't remember.
They do. They always have the movie before the movie.
But then when they play the credit sequences, show you what's going to happen in the movie.
Gives you images
like in the TV show.
Yeah.
See, the James Bond, and this is something I say in my TV book. Like, I have a whole section of different types of these things, and the James Bond cold open is another trick TV shows do and pilots in order to grab the attention that I like better, that I'm personally more a fan of than just doing like, you'll see this 20 minutes from now. Hold up. Just watch all the other boring stuff. Yeah. That's my take.
Okay. Well,
thank you. Thank you, Thomas Havernick, for that question.
Yeah.
It's good stuff.
And if anybody else has questions about this episode, another episode, just anything in general, wants to hear us cover other topics that we're not talking about,
we might say
no. Send us a question. We might say no.
Expect some no's. It's not going to be yes all the time.
I will say I was very excited that we got 3 emails this month after like nothing for 100 episodes. So it was fun.
Well, now I guess we should encourage people to use the email instead of messaging us on Twitter or X
Twitter, man.
So now we can't rely on that as much. So use the email if you want to say something to us, or you know, send us a nice picture you photoshopped. That's happened before. Whatever you want.
Writers Blockbusters Podcast at gmail.com.
Right. Is there anything left that you guys want to plug, say, anything?
No, I'll just say, Bob, thanks for doing this one. I didn't know that you weren't crazy about this movie.
No.
Yeah.
I think it was a challenge to do.
I gave the wrong impression. I'm excited always to do the show.
Yeah. No,
the actual watching of this movie is something that rarely for this show have I ever hesitated on. That's what I meant. That's all.
The one advantage, this movie isn't super long.
It's not.
I mean,
it's not 90 minutes. Twice, but... though. That's the thing. Like, for the show, I try to watch the movie twice all the time.
Yeah.
And I didn't even want to watch it once. That kind of thing. I was like, I don't even really want to watch Memento at all. So, yeah, that was the only thing. I didn't want to give the impression I didn't want to do it for the show. It's... The part of the show is our enjoyment of watching the movie that we're going to talk about. And then that's the only reason I brought it up. And now I think it's a great movie. It's not for me because of all those reasons I already said.
Yeah.
That's all. Yeah. So I'm sure I'll get shit from some friends that are like, you don't like Memento? What's wrong
with
you?
Man, I got shit when we did the Hereditary episode. So that's totally
You got
fine.
A lot of shit for that.
I did.
Yeah. So that's fair. I'll take the Memento shit. Even though I'm saying it's
Jimmy,
a great
you don't
movie.
Know what the fuck you're talking about. It's the greatest horror movie of all time. Shut the fuck
Can
up.
Can I just say, I'll say to you guys, don't you think there's another universe, another multiverse, where Guy Pearce was kind of his golden boy for the rest of his career and he played Oppenheimer?
Yeah,
because I was watching this movie and I was like, Guy Pearce could probably also kick ass as Oppenheimer, like performance wise.
He would have been a great Scarecrow.
Yeah. And I'm just like, I wonder why, like, also Joey Pants hasn't been in any of his movies since. I wonder why that connection never was brought through with his career.
He could have been Batman.
Guy Pearce.
Yeah.
That might not be too bad. That's not bad.
I mean, I don't think he's that far off from Bale, to be honest.
No.
I think they're similar types.
Where is he?
Yeah.
I could see it. But I'm just like, how come that didn't happen? I want to know that it's not script stuff. I just want to know the story of why that didn't continue.
My thing is, Carrie Ann Moss, why wasn't she ever in more stuff?
I don't understand.
I think it's a personal choice. She's great. Yeah. She is incredible.
Super selective and of what I she insulted spends her time doing. Good for her.
I know I insulted her character's place in the movie. It is not because of her whatsoever. She's incredible.
No,
I really love her as an actress.
It just seems like she could do so many different things, you know? And it just seems like people would be dying to put her in their movies.
Every time she appears in something, she just knocks it out of the park. Like every time. So. But she,
I'm always like,
I think it was a personal decision, though. I feel like I remember her saying that. Like she, it was a family. I'm going to step away. She had the Matrix and then she stepped away. It was like too much.
Gotcha.
You know, and good for her. That's true.
Good for her.
Yeah. And she came back for Matrix 4 and everything.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't know. She's great.
Should have been her story. Yeah. By the way,
I might like it more.
Yeah.
If it was a different perspective like
if
that.
If it was Trinity's perspective of all of that, it would have been so good. Anyway.
Well, I meant this movie, but yeah. Trinity, what? Sure.
She would have been great in Clean Slate.
If she put her in that. We have met her Clean Slate like five times during this.
It's great.
Nobody knows what we're talking about. I don't even know if that's available to watch anywhere.
I want to get a mention on Dana Carvey's podcast. That's the only reason I'm saying it. Somehow he'll listen to this just to hear us talk about Clean Slate six times.
Well, there's not many Dana Carvey starring roles. It's Clean Slate, Master Disguise, and what's that other one where he's a con artist?
Wayne's World.
Well, Wayne's World counts. Yeah, that's right. Wayne's World counts. But there's one where he's a con artist that I absolutely love. I can't remember the name.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
You know what I'm talking about? Right? Yes. Robert Loggia is in it.
God.
Yeah.
Somebody is screaming at the speakers. Whoever hasn't tuned off already. Yeah.
But so I'm going to try to find Clean Slate and watch it because of this podcast now.
We could do another revisit where we just do Clean Slate's, you know, story ingredients versus Mementos.
You know what? People would actually probably like us doing 50 First Dates because it's so out of character.
No, I know. If we were to do any Adam Sandler, that would go high on my list.
Really? Okay.
Yes.
All right.
I love Drew Barrymore and Adam Sandler. Yes.
My wife sat down next to me watching this, and that was what she said. She said, "This is just like 50 First Dates."
That's awesome.
This is like 50 First Dates, not the other way around.
That's awesome.
Right. That's incredible. Okay. That's everything. Everybody go watch Clean Slate and then email us.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Bye, everyone.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Hey, this is Bob Rose, and thank you for listening to Writer's Blockbusters. If you'd like to financially support the show, please consider joining my Patreon. I've been producing the podcast for several years completely out of pocket, and I'd like to keep producing it ad-free and no longer at a loss. If you'd like to help, head on over to patreon.com/BobRoseSucks. That's right. Bob Rose sucks. And if you want the one and only Jimmy George to help polish up that writing project you're kind of struggling with, head on over to scriptbutcher.com. As a listener, you already know he's the best there is. Scriptbutcher.com. You can also support the show by simply sharing it or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate both. Thank you for listening and see you next episode.